Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hey, folks, this is The Takeaway for Wednesday, August 24th, 2016. Remember, leave us a voice memo if you want to be heard on the show. Email it to takeawaydigital@gmail.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. We thank you so much for listening. More shelling by the Turkish military on ISIS targets along Turkey's border with northern Syria. Turkish tanks even went into northern Syria pursuing ISIS targets earlier today. The U.S. is continuing airstrikes against the group in Libya and in Iraq. The Iraqi military is reported to be closer to retaking the city of Mosul from the Islamic State. And the United Nations Refugee Agency announced this week that 1.2 million Iraqis could be displaced in the efforts to remove the terrorist group from the city. Now, most Westerners watching this part of the conflict from afar have not experienced the fight against ISIS the way Christiane Boudreau has. We begin our hour with her story, one that probably would have remained secret if she hadn't insisted that it get out. Christiane Boudreau was a Canadian mother of two when her 22-year-old son, Damien Clermont, flew to Turkey, joined ISIS, and crossed the border into Syria to join the fighting. Damien's story of radicalization was one of a slow unraveling, from a happy childhood to teenage years plagued by depression. Boudreau says she never expected he was capable of joining a terrorist group. She didn't realize how bad things were until she heard about his death from a reporter. By then, her own government had begun trying to keep this whole story secret and eventually revoked her passport, preventing her from returning home. Boudreau spoke with me from France, where she's currently staying. Her son Damien was one of 4,500 Westerners who've joined ISIS.
Damien grew up as a very social child, very well integrated in the community. He was extremely intelligent, athletic, outgoing, happy-go-lucky. Didn't seem like there was ever a care in the world. Then as he got into his teen years, he struggled with some depression and had a difficult time, I'd say, when he hit about 14, until he turned 17, when he'd had a suicide attempt, a serious one, and was hospitalized for a couple of months. After he came out of the hospital, he started searching for something more, more meaning in life, to keep him going, and he found Islam. And that's when he converted. So that would have been 2008, and that was a really positive influence in his life for the first 3 years of his conversion.
So once this conversion first happened, was it something that you were happy with because it brought him around to a more positive outlook?
Sure. I mean, just seeing him relaxed and calm, feeling better about himself, getting out again, finding work, making friends again, because he kept himself in the house for the couple of years before his suicide attempt. So he kind of cut himself off from all the friendships he'd had. So I was relieved, if anything, to think that if he'd found something with meaning like that, then we wouldn't have any more suicide attempts, and that it was important for him, so it was important for me.
So Damien converted to Islam, things started looking up, and then what happened?
Well, things were looking up for three whole years, so it was a relief, like I said. Then he moved to a different part of the city. And when he did that, he was pretty much cut off from the original mosque that he was attending due to transportation issues. It was difficult for him to get there. He met some new people in his life, and that's when we started to see changes in him. He became much more agitated again, anxious almost, very cut off and private from the family. So he would come visit, but if he had a phone call that came through, he would take it outside so he wouldn't hear the conversation. Or if a friend came to pick him up, whereas before they would come in, say hello, shake everybody's hands, sit and chat for a bit, now there were new friends and they were picking up around the corner from the house.
And when did you really start to worry about all of this?
Well, I didn't even begin to worry, except more or less more about the depression, I guess, coming back. That was my biggest fear. But he still kept talking about a positive future. And when the initial suicide attempt happened, his biggest thing was that he'd not done anything with his life up until then. He felt he hadn't been productive. So the fact he was talking about future becoming an imam and everything, I didn't think that was a concern quite then. I just wanted him to calm down, and I figured over time he'll find that happy medium, that balance.
And then at a certain point, Damien told you that he was going on a trip to Egypt, but that wasn't really the case.
Exactly. So what he started talking about was going to Egypt to study Arabic and becoming an imam. What I didn't realize was because he'd taken a ride from somebody else to get to the airport, that he was actually flying into Istanbul, Turkey. He stayed in Turkey from November 2012, at the beginning of November, until the latter part of December 2012. And at that point, that's when he crossed the border.
And were you more or less unaware of what he was up to in terms of really joining ISIS and combat until you heard through a phone call that he had in fact been killed?
Exactly. Well, I'd had an opportunity to talk to him. I was talking to him while I thought he was in Egypt. All along he was in Turkey. So we would have discussions on the phone every 2 or 3 days, and everything seemed normal. I'd ask if he was eating okay, how his studies were going. I didn't know that when I was asking him about studies and he was answering, he meant training for combat. I lost touch with him when he first crossed the border. Then I received news from our security intelligence service at the end of January. They believed he'd actually gone into Syria. They'd been watching him for almost 2 years, and he'd been part of a group of young men in our city in Calgary. They were all leaving one by one to go into Syria or Iraq.
And when you got that news from the intelligence service suggesting that your son had joined one of the most notorious terrorist groups operating in the world right now, it's hard for me to ask even what was your reaction?
Well, at the time, ISIS really didn't exist, or nobody knew about it. We weren't aware of it in the media. We barely heard anything about the war in Syria, the civil war, on television. It was something I didn't even really understand. But I was violently physically ill for the first day when I received the news. It was basically shock.
So what has been the reaction of your government since then? You are currently in France. You're a Canadian citizen. And as I understand it, you have not been allowed to travel back to your own country in Canada. So what's going on with your own government?
It was a big issue. Even when Damien was over in Syria and I was still communicating with him, I was harassed by the Security Intelligence Service. I had our federal authorities ask me to help with the investigation with everything. But I was getting very antsy because nobody was, in turn, was giving help to the family. I said we needed some sort of emotional, psychological support. They kept saying, yes, yes, we're going to help, just have patience. Their biggest fear was that I was going to go public with the information. They were trying to keep it hidden and trying to keep it secret. And actually, one of the security intelligence agents had said to me, if you go public, it's going to destroy the image that Canada has, and there's going to be repercussions and consequences for that. And here we go. This is what's happened since. As I was trying to educate people so that they could be aware to stop their youth, here's the retaliation. I'm stuck in a country that's not my own. Thank goodness I'm here with my parents. I'd rather be with them anyway. But it's caused a lot of other difficulties as well.
So just to be clear, you're alleging that the Canadian government has confiscated your passport and that you can't travel back to Canada as retaliation for you having discussions like this one and going public about your son's conversion and joining ISIS.
That's what I'm feeling. I'm feeling the pressure. They were afraid that I would go to court against them because the way the case was handled in the beginning, they didn't try to stop him. And I kept trying to get answers. Why was he given a brand new passport 2 months before leaving if he was on a watch list? If we had have been known or been made aware, why wasn't there an attempt to arrest him, stop him? At first, they said there weren't any laws in place, but I researched it, and there were. There were since 2011. So I know none of that's true. And it's my understanding that they're trying to keep it quiet. They just don't want the issue to be raised on a regular basis.
there has been so much discussion, so much written about sort of the ingredients that go into radicalization in different places around the world. And it seems like in so many ways, your son fit the profile, right? Young, 17, 18, disaffected, looking for a stronger identity, finding a community, possibly among very conservative or in some cases radical Islamists, wherever he may be. So in those senses, it sounds like he fits the mold, if I can say it that way. But your own personal experience with your son's radicalization, what did it show you about the way this ideology can grip on to a young man in the way that it did with Damien?
Well, it's easy to understand and see with all the life's frustrations and complexities that everybody's facing, especially our youth today. If you have some sort of emotional turmoil, there aren't a lot of resources out there for them to turn to for some sort of positive guidance, and it festers for a while. And they pick up on it. They're very intelligent. The recruiters are very, very intelligent. They build up the community as a family. They make it seem that this is where you're most accepted, where they're going to make you feel wonderful about yourself and build you up. It doesn't take that much if you're in that position of vulnerability. When somebody's offering you solutions, some sort of comfort, support, how easy it is to turn and think that's the answer and believe it and be convicted that that's exactly what it is and committed to the cause.
Do you think that in your case, Canadians, your government certainly are so against the idea of acknowledging that radicalization could be a problem in their own country, that efforts like this, you know, to bring awareness to other parents aren't getting the help that they probably could use?
They're not getting the help. I mean, I still communicate with parents over there, the help and support for the families, the ripple effect that it causes, that support is just not there. And whenever an incident happens, they talk about it again. They're going to fund it, a program. They've been talking about programs since I started going public with it. And nothing ever comes to fruition. Everything dies down and then it gets put away on a shelf again. And it's unfortunate because even once ISIS is defeated, they're not the only organization out there. There's al-Nusra, al-Qaeda. There's right-wing extremism that's building and growing cults just because of the turmoil that our world's in. And as long as they keep putting it away and not dealing with the root issues and putting those supports in place for the families, we're not going to have any solution whatsoever, and it's just going to be a continuation in one group after another.
Christiane Boudreau is co-founder of Mothers for Life. She's a Canadian mother from Calgary. Her son, Damien Clermont, joined ISIS and was killed fighting with ISIS in Syria. She spoke to me from France. Christiane Boudreau, thank you.
Thank you.
Christiane Boudreau's story was brought to us as part of an ongoing collaboration with News Deeply. That's an award-winning media platform that covers critical and underreported stories from all over the world. To see more of what they're up to on this story and others like it, visit their website, newsdeeply.com/womenandgirls.
When I was like 14 years old, I got arrested and beat up by the police. And that was like a really eye-opening, politicizing moment for me. And from there, the politics of punk rock really kept me involved in it and kept me around with it, was that it was intelligent.
Later on this hour, our People Get Ready protest music series continues. We're joined by Laura Jane Grace, a musician who burned her birth certificate on stage. She shouted in front of a screaming audience, "Goodbye, gender," before her band Against Me slammed into another vicious punk song.
It just feels even powerful just to be myself now. Not even having to say anything, but just being able to be comfortable being myself on stage is like a revolutionary thing for even me personally.
Coming up later here on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
If you can't do everything, at least do what you say. I just want to live in a country that knows the difference between love and hate.
That's the voice of poet Ebony Stewart, one of 50 writers who crafted messages to the incoming president, whoever that might be, as part of the Poets and Writers Dear President Project. Now, we've been asking you to do the very same thing. We got this from Charlotte, North Carolina. Be honest with us. Work with Congress to reach good decisions that benefit the country as a whole. Understand that special interests are just that. Well, yesterday we heard from poet Evie Shockley. She focused on climate change in her message. Today we go to Reginald Dwayne Betts, who wrote his message to a potential President Hillary Clinton.
Your critics, most of them, would have called me super predator back then, too, when the memory of the pistol was heavy in palm, and so that's not my focus. But now, unlike then, you have more power, and I'm left to wonder what you will call the young men and women lost in the system, those who walk down paths they regret. Do they earn your scorn or your mercy?
Betts knows what it means to be thought a super predator. In 1996, at just the age of 16, he was caught in a carjacking incident and sentenced as an adult to over 8 years in prison, including a year in solitary confinement at a supermax facility. Dwayne Betts is now a writer, the author of A Question of Freedom, for which he won an NAACP Image Award, as well as Bastards of the Reagan Era. He's also a recent graduate of Yale Law School. Dwayne, welcome to the show.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
This idea of the super predator that you wrote about in your letter to the president that you just read, Hillary Clinton herself apologized earlier in this campaign for statements back in the 90s referring to super predators at a time when America was terrified of crime. Is this idea dead in America, or is it still with us?
Oh, it's definitely still with us. I think apologies are great, but the reality is that there were policies crafted around that rhetoric, and those policies still exist. So right now, in every state, you have juveniles, 15, 16, 17-year-olds, being tried as adults, being sent to prison with adults. And it's not just for the most heinous crimes, because that's the story. That's where super predator comes from. And it follows you for the rest of your life.
So the idea here is that the justice system and people in it view young black men not just as offenders or people on trial, but as super offenders or something to be feared greater than themselves.
For instance, in my case, I don't think my prosecutor actually thought I was feared and dangerous. I think that he saw a kid who had made a profound mistake, who had robbed somebody. I don't think he really saw me as feared and dangerous, but he wasn't willing to see me as somebody who could be redeemed. And it's a connection between the rhetoric and the policies and the inability for us to imagine young folks who get in a bad spot to be able to overcome that.
So this is personal for you because as a young man, you did have a gun in your hand and you did commit a crime and now you're a lawyer.
It's absolutely personal. And when I went through that, there was very few people in the courtroom who imagined me graduating from the University of Maryland, who imagined me getting a master's degree in poetry from Warren Wilson College, or ultimately getting a law degree from Yale Law School. And I just believe that if we shifted the rhetoric, if we broadened our imagination, then we could make decisions around people who have made mistakes that actually lead to them growing and them being an asset to their society and their communities.
Some of the ideas around criminal justice in prisons are changing in this country. We've all seen the movements towards reform, and some of those are slow moving. But are you encouraged by the way policymakers are changing their thinking about prisons and about incarceration and even about sentencing?
So I am encouraged, but I just think that rhetoric, that propaganda anchored the conversation in a way that we haven't gotten away from yet. We're struggling to make changes on that front. You know, that's what a presidential candidate, that's what a president could do to change the national language around that conversation.
You addressed your letter to Hillary Clinton, I guess, because you think she's going to win, right?
Think, hope, pray, expect. Yeah.
And I mentioned earlier in our conversation that Hillary Clinton apologized for statements earlier in her career about super predators. But just this week, as Donald Trump tries to show the optics of opening his campaign to people of color, minorities, and black folks, he made a speech where he basically said to walk down the street in a black community is to risk being shot. This is an image that kind of persists the idea of the super predator. I mean, no matter what you do, you're in danger.
Right. But I think, one, we have to recognize that this isn't new for Donald Trump. So while Secretary Clinton has apologized for her comments from 1994, Donald Trump hasn't apologized for that one-page ad he took out in the New York Times around the Central Park Five. And he hasn't apologized once they've been found innocent. He hasn't apologized once he realized that they spent all of that time in prison for a crime they didn't commit. So, one, I think that this is just par for the course for him. And I think that he's just tapping into a mythology that still persists. And until we create a counter-narrative, we'll always have these opportunities for zealots to just tap into that mythology and bring back all of those old memories and the racism and prejudice that still exists in the system today will remain.
What did it mean to you that Hillary Clinton did meet with some of the leaders of Black Lives Matter and affiliated movements? Those meetings, I think, were some time ago in the campaign. Is that encouraging to you? What does it say to you about the direction of at least that campaign?
I mean, like, ultimately, these are small steps. I recognize that Secretary Clinton is well aware of the work that the Black Lives Matter advocates are doing. But I'm also certain that she's well aware of the work of people like Brian Stevenson. I'm certain that she's well aware of the work of a wide range of attorneys and lawyers and civil rights organizations that are still doing work on this issue today. The question really is, when will we get to the point that that awareness is linked to some policy initiatives? That's really what we need to see. We need to see more than just meetings. We need to see some practical changes. And, of course, that can't happen until she's in office. But I think that we have to say that what we demand, what we want, what we require is more than a meeting.
The project is Dear President from Poets and Writers, 50 letters from 50 writers to the new president, whoever that is, and our latest contributor, Reginald Dwayne Betts. He's a poet and author of A Question of Freedom and Bastards of the Reagan Era, and he just graduated from Yale Law School. Dwayne Betts, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. The school year is here, and for a lot of kids, that means toting those EpiPens to school to treat severe allergic reactions. Now, some public schools require students with severe allergies to provide two of those life-saving devices in case of emergency, but the price for those EpiPens has shot up over the last couple of years. A pack of two injectors is up to $700 in some places, an average price increase of more than 450% over the last 8 years. Now, only one company makes EpiPens. They're called Mylan Pharmaceuticals. They have a near monopoly on the medicine. They're charging hundreds when it costs around $5 to make the injector. The hormone in EpiPens is epinephrine. That itself is pretty cheap. Only about a dollar's worth is in each EpiPen. Now, Congress is on the case now. A couple of senators are calling for investigations into these price hikes. Tracy Bush is a mom and food allergy consultant. She deals with this problem personally and professionally. Her son has allergies that are potentially deadly, and she recently got an insurance waiver that cut the cost for EpiPens. But she says it's not an option for a lot of families who were forced to go without. Tracy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
But why doesn't insurance pay for these EpiPens for a lot of the kids who need them?
It depends on everyone's insurance. Everyone has a different insurance policy, high deductibles. But regardless of what type of insurance you do or don't have, the fact is that if the EpiPen was affordable to begin with, it would be a non-issue.
So tell me about your own cost. You have an insurance waiver now, but clearly you didn't always have it. What did your own bills look like?
In 2008, it would have been about $100 to have a twin pack of EpiPen. As opposed to this year, it would have been about $1,800 out of pocket for three twin packs. So that's a large piece of money for anyone to have to spend to save a life.
Now, as we said, Mylan Pharmaceuticals has a monopoly here, so the idea of going to the competition doesn't really work. What other strategies are there to either go to the insurance company and try to get a waiver like you did, or find some cost savings here?
Some people are able to utilize the zero copay that is available through EpiPen. Other people, like I said, have, you know, can work with their pharmacist and doctor to write out the prescription correctly. One of the key things is to have a good pharmacist that will actually do a lot of the legwork for you. If you have your physician write it out on the prescription, three twin EpiPen twin packs, as opposed to paying three times for one, that would save you a little bit of money, if that makes sense.
In the past year, we've seen a lot of media outrage over people like Martin Shkreli, the pharmaceutical executive who raised the price of another drug and was vilified in the public for it. The reaction to this is similar, but what do you make of what's going on in the industry here?
I'm going to assume that they're like any other company, and they probably saw a profit, you know, in the waiting and took it. The difference is that this is a life-saving item they created to save lives. Making a lot of money is not helping us save lives. You know, they make over 1,400 different pharmaceuticals, so they need to adjust their budget just like we need to adjust our budget.
There are alternatives to EpiPens. There are other brands, and there is competition. It's just some of them have run into FDA approval problems, or they have injectors that some doctors consider too complicated.
Correct. Adrenaclick is out there. But actually, in the next year or two, there are promising items that are also coming on the market that might actually beat out the EpiPen due to the smaller size and the expiration date being extended.
Okay, so that suggests that maybe while it's bad now, competition may help take care of this problem.
Yes, absolutely.
And how long is that going to take?
I am being told that sometime in 2017, at least one of the items should hit the market if it's approved.
And in the meantime, has Mylan said that they're going to have any additional programs to help people pay and also maybe protect their own PR here?
To my knowledge, I have not seen anything pop up from them yet about this situation, which surprises me. I'm waiting to hear something, and I would hope that they would reach out and let their consumers know that something is going on, their thoughts, they're working on it, anything.
Tracy Bush, mom and allergy food consultant who has a son with severe allergies and one of the many people confronting steep price increases for EpiPen epinephrine shots. Tracy Bush, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A catastrophic 6.2 magnitude earthquake hit central Italy in the early hours this morning. Italian officials are reporting dozens dead, with more casualties expected as rescue crews and volunteers continue to scour the debris for survivors, sometimes with their bare hands. During Pope Francis's morning audience with pilgrims, he led those assembled in a prayer for the earthquake victims. The greatest devastation took place in Amatrice, a town of 2,000 residents about 80 miles northeast of Rome. The mayor of Amatrice says that half of the town no longer exists. Joining us now from the scene in Amatrice is Christopher Livesay. He's an independent journalist based in Rome. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Christopher, what are you seeing as you roam the streets there and look at the buildings in Amatrice?
Well, I'm seeing a lot of buildings that are destroyed, quite frankly. It looks like the aftermath of a barrel bombing or something we're used to seeing from Syria, the entire buildings that are completely leveled. And these are buildings that were built centuries ago before earthquake proofing existed. So it's quite devastating. And there's a steady flow of rescue workers moving in and out of the places of destruction, putting people on ambulances and then air-evacuing them to nearby hospitals. So they've got their work cut out for them. There are people who are still trapped beneath the rubble and who they can still communicate with in some cases. So it's going to be a long day.
So Amatrice is an old town, probably hundreds of years old. I assume it's a town with stone buildings and a lot of narrow streets.
Exactly. In fact, those two components are probably what's making this as difficult as it is. The stone buildings, as I mentioned before, we're not talking about earthquake-proof buildings. They're the worst thing you can imagine. So the debris is heavy, and it's falling on people and causing a lot of injuries. And then, of course, you've got the narrow, winding roads, which are making it difficult for rescuers not just to reach some of the afflicted, but also just to negotiate the street and the space with other rescue vehicles. There's hundreds of rescue workers here from, you know, local hospitals and ambulance drivers to, National Protection Service as well. So they're all having to come to a compromise and figure out who's going to take the lead in various situations.
But is this a place, you mentioned, of course, that the old and ancient buildings aren't earthquake proof. That makes sense. But is this even a region that has any expectation of earthquakes? Is there any sort of institutionalized preparedness built into this?
Absolutely. This is a region that's familiar with earthquakes. And when I say a region, I should mention that this earthquake is several earthquakes that stretch across several regions, all the way from Lazio, which is the region around Rome, to the Marche region, which is on the other side of the boot, shall we say. But generally speaking, this is central Italy around the Apennine Mountains, which has been known for devastating earthquakes in the past. The most infamous would be in 2009 in the nearby city of L'Aquila. That was a similar magnitude earthquake, actually slightly less powerful. It was a 6.0 magnitude quake, and that killed over 300 people in the city of L'Aquila. Now, L'Aquila was a proper city, is a proper city. At the time, it had 80,000 residents. The town I'm in, it only has 2,000, but because it's the holiday season, and this is August, and it's a cute kind of picturesque part of the country, it had a lot of holiday makers. So a town of 2,000, they estimate, was easily a town of 4,000 right now.
A 6.2 magnitude earthquake has hit the central city of Amatrice in Italy, a town of only about 2,000 people. And as Christopher Livesay reports, there are still apparently survivors below the rubble communicating with rescuers as they move to try to move that rubble out of the way and deal with the devastation. Italian authorities already reporting more than 60 people dead. Christopher Livesay, independent journalist based in Rome. Thanks for your report.
Thank you for having me.
Good evening. The four-day insurrection at New York's Attica State Prison came to a tragic end this morning. Negotiations gave way to force, making this the bloodiest prison incident the country has seen in four decades.
That was the lead story on the CBS Evening News on September 13th, 1971. Of course, Walter Cronkite there. The uprising at Attica Prison in upstate New York still remains one of the bloodiest prison encounters in U.S. history. And part of the story that came out of Attica was one of overcrowded and inhumane prison conditions. But more than that, the Attica prison riot remained shrouded in controversy for years afterward for the vast cover-ups and lies and secrecy surrounding the retaking of the prison and how it was falsely portrayed by authorities to the American public. Heather Ann Thompson is an award-winning historian at the University of Michigan. She spent more than a decade researching and piecing together documents and accounts of the Attica insurrection. The result is her book, out just this week, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. It's a legacy that she says remains relevant even today.
Attica lives on because it really plays out over the next four decades with the prisoners and the hostages who had been mistreated in the prison during the retaking, trying to get justice from the state of New York. But it also lived on because Americans everywhere came to watch their country lock up more and more people, become really the country with the largest incarceration rate. And so Attica became this kind of pivot point where, you know, people are protesting for better prison rights, but ironically, we end up with some of the most brutal conditions today. So it's a really interesting thing to look back at.
Is that pivot point what drew you to the story and this exhaustive retelling and research that you've done?
I was drawn to it both for the pivot, that is to say, what it says about where we ended up today, but I was also really interested in it because Attica remained, despite the various memoirs written and despite the numerous lawsuits, Attica has really remained shrouded in secrecy. The state of New York has worked very hard to kind of keep the records of Attica sealed away, hidden away from the public. And so the book journey for me, which was a 13-year journey to really uncover what had happened at Attica, was as much about telling the victims' stories and, you know, sort of getting the history on the record in a way that it had never been, as it was about trying to figure out what Attica meant for the future of the nation.
One of the most alarming chapters in the aftermath of Attica is the string of cover-ups that you've described in this book, where state troopers who went in to retake the prison after the fact told stories of killing inmates in self-defense. And this book really chronicles case after case where those claims of self-defense just didn't hold up.
And in fact, the reverse was true, that the prisoners who were left in the yard and the hostages who were also in the yard were the ones who endured real brutality, not just in the minutes of the retaking where so many bullets were shot into such a small enclosed space, but really for weeks and for months. Indeed, the long-term costs of this retaking were devastating. And so the police had a great interest in not revealing that, and indeed were very successful in protecting themselves. 39 people died as a result of law enforcement bullets. No police officer ever stood trial for that.
Many of the most important parts of this story in retrospect are told through the eyes of a man named Malcolm Bell. Can you describe who Malcolm Bell was and how he wound up being so important to the story that you're telling here?
I mean, he's one of these guys who was just doing his job as a lawyer and then as a prosecutor working with the state of New York to make sure that there was a thorough investigation of what had happened at Attica. And he was actually assigned to look into the potential trooper crimes. He wanted to follow the evidence no matter where it led him. And he became very concerned when it seemed to him that the evidence was quite overwhelming about trooper crimes and even corrections officer crimes in the yard. And he was effectively, sidelined. He was unable to get these indictments. So he had to become a whistleblower. And part of my journey was to figure out, what he knew, what he had found. And while he wouldn't disclose that because of, his standing as an officer of the court, part of my research journey was to kind of figure it out and to kind of do what he couldn't do, which is to really shine a more public light on that cover up.
What was your own experience with the state of New York, with various authorities in trying to uncover parts of this story that hadn't previously been told?
Well, I mean, it was a mixed bag. In the early years of doing the research, it was kind of hit or miss. I was able to get some materials, but over the years, it became clear that the most important records really remained off limits. So I wasn't going to get those. And so I happened to have a bit of luck finding records that clearly no one knew were just sitting there in a courthouse. And so I got much of the story that way. But I also got the story from many of these lawyers who had worked tirelessly over 40 years to at least get those stories on the record.
So Heather Ann Thompson, we're in this moment now of prison reform, criminal justice reform, a national debate about that. We've seen the federal government just in recent days cutting off their relationship with private prisons, a small move, but a significant one. Put Attica in the context of this, because in 1971, Americans got a view of inmates in prison that was very different than many of them might have today.
Well, I think that's right. And that's another reason why I was really committed to rescuing the story. The fact is that the most brutality that happens at Attica, the reason why Attica becomes a bloodbath is not because of the prisoners. It is because of the law enforcement retaking. And that is a story that America did not learn at the time. The state of New York stood right outside of that prison and said that the prisoners had actually killed the hostages. It wasn't true. But that story went out on the AP. It went out in every small town newspaper. It was on the front page of the New York Times, the LA Times. And I think that that was a devastating blow to prisoner rights because it basically distorted what had happened. And the nation was growing increasingly willing to clamp down on civil rights and increasingly willing to clamp down on prisoner rights, but often having been sold a completely false story about what was going on. In fact, prior to the retaking of Attica, Americans were remarkably sympathetic to prisoner rights and on the need for guard training and better living conditions. One of the places we end up today is paying the price for that backlash to something that was never real. And so we now have this opportunity to redo it, I think. And that's what this moment we're in right now. But if we don't understand what happens behind bars, we are likely to get it wrong again and treat our most vulnerable citizens, barbarically and not even know it.
Heather Ann Thompson is the author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI.
Music don't change the world.
There's something happening here.
Got to fight the power of the beast.
We shall overcome.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised.
Music don't change the world. Only the audience can change the world. But a good songwriter can offer a different perspective.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. In this hot summer of 2016, People Get Ready. It's our series on the songs and artists whose music has something to say. For what's been nearly 20 years, Laura Jane Grace has been the front woman of the punk band Against Me. Since coming out as transgender in 2012, Grace has been a visible advocate for LGBTQ rights in America. And her music has reflected that. Here's True Trans Soul Rebel from 2014's Transgender Dysphoria Blues.
God bless your transsexual heart.
John Hockenberry caught up with Grace to talk about what democracy feels like today and the punk rebellion that remains at the heart of her music.
That was the point of why my band Against Me started, was because I wanted to sing protest songs. At the time, especially being really involved with the activist community, things that were happening like around the anti-WTO protests and stuff like that in Seattle or D.C. or wherever, you know, that was the scene that my band started in.
How did what happened in the aftermath of HB2 in North Carolina on stage sort of go beyond simply singing a song, a protest song?
Well, it brought attention to a very real issue, something that really actually affects people. I was almost surprised because I just assumed that was the way it already was in North Carolina, that I already kind of operate with that kind of level of fear. You know, I didn't think twice about canceling. I wanted to go there. You know, I wanted to be visible.
I, for one, have come here to be reborn. How about you? So let's start this off right. I brought my birth certificate with me.
Burning your birth certificate on stage, what was the reaction?
You know, it's symbolism, it's protest, and that's, you know, that's really important. Different from state to state. But when I came out and when I started transition, I lived in Florida. And that meant that I had to undergo about 6 months of intensive psychotherapy to get a letter that said I wasn't crazy and that I could start on hormone replacement therapy. So if you're going by like what a piece of paper says, shouldn't the more recent updated piece of paper be the one you defer to as opposed to the one that you received 35 years ago when you couldn't even speak? It just seems like it's, you know, obviously a bill aimed at preventing people from being able to even transition and to be respected for their gender identity.
What movement were you joining when you first got into this?
First got into punk rock?
Yeah, yeah.
Initially, it was really the nihilism of it that attracted me. And just, you know, having before that kind of gone through the period of time where I was into classic rock bands, you know, Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, The Beatles, whatever, I started getting beat up a lot because I had long hair. And punk rock seemed more about fighting back as opposed to the hippie movement, which seemed more about taking it, you know, and being nonviolent. So I liked that aspect of it, of that even if I was going to get beat up, I'd get a couple punches in. But then when I was like 14 years old, I got arrested and beat up by the police. And that was like a really eye-opening politicizing moment for me. And from there, the politics of punk rock really kept me involved in it and kept me around with it, was that it was intelligent. 150 Maryland's the war and the bomb. All reasons to be fearful, but every day new to wake up. 333, say the thing to me. They bring it all back to me.
Well, it comes through very strongly. I'm wondering if on stage as a protest musician, do you feel the same kind of power of telling people who you are, conveying to them stuff that when you were growing up, it was not possible to convey?
It just feels even powerful just to be myself now, you know, like not even having to say anything, but just being able to be comfortable being myself on stage is like a revolutionary thing for even me personally. But I think that not changing for other people, like that is a revolutionary act in a world where so many people are fake and so many people put on fronts and are deceptive in that way.
So in the summer of 16, what aspect of politics, of protest are you most engaged in right now and the fans of Against Me?
Well, you know, obviously like with things like HB2, you know, trans rights movement, I'm very involved in that and being visible and vocal with that. This is obviously an election year and there's, you know, a lot of heated debate and things around that. I kind of feel like for whatever reason, my reaction right now is wanting to take a step back and kind of disengage, where it seems like in this day and age, like with more and more social media involvement, that like the arguments are becoming so much more heated and everyone's just kind of trying to say their own opinion and add a thing to it, that it's like maybe the thing to do is to take a step back and to not participate in an argument. Like if you saw two people having a really dumb argument, the thing to do is to not jump into their dumb argument and try to convince one of the other either way. Maybe just let them have their dumb argument and sort it out, you know?
Well, that dumb argument idea raises a question that is you're not the first one to raise, and that is the idea that what we think of as American democracy has migrated away from politics somewhere, and that people experience their democracy maybe in social media, maybe they express it on the stage, maybe they express it in the art that they're doing, maybe they express it in a community of local issues. But where is democracy if it's not in the election? And do you think that democracy, as we understand it in America, has moved away from this thing called the election?
Of course, yeah, yeah. I think that if you were to ask most people on the street to even define democracy, that they wouldn't be able to define democracy or tell you how this is a democracy that we live in. I'm really skeptical when it comes to, like, the way American elections are. I don't know, like, having a two-party system like that where it's either a Democrat or a Republican every single time always is that doesn't seem like democracy.
So is this a burn, baby, burn moment? Is it a we rebuild from the ground up, we shall overcome? Is it a what sentiment would you use to rebuild and get to the other side of whatever the hell this is?
I guess, like, to speak in cliches, it's like, you know, be the change you want to see. Think globally, act locally, you know. But really, you have to be the example in the world that you want to see.
Where do you think that all stands today? Is it? It's not mainstream music, but then mainstream music doesn't matter in the same way that it used to. There's lots of stuff that exists and is meaningful, even if it's not mainstream.
Well, you know, I think that's like, you know, the sign of a good protest song is that if it can kind of transcend generations and if the message behind the protest song can still be relevant, even if the specific of what was being protested with that song isn't applicable. For instance, my all-time favorite punk band is the band Crass. Are you gonna be the big man, the Tommy gun? We talk of freedom when the blood begins to run. Freedom has no value, your finance is the price. I want your revolution, I want anarchy and peace. You talk about my power. Singing songs about, like, you know, sheep farming in the Falklands. And you know, singing songs against the Queen. And for a 14-year-old kid living in South Florida, that didn't have anything to do with me. But I got the message behind it, you know, and that spirit of protest behind it.
Well, Laura Jean Grace, front woman of Against Me, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The new album from Against Me is called Shapeshift With Me. It's out September 19th. There's a whole lot more to our People Get Ready protest music series. You can check all of it out at the website at thetakeaway.org/protestmusic. And tune in next week for the final installment with Saul Williams as we close out our summer. You can give us a call to talk about anything you've heard on the show. The number is 8778-MY-TAKE. You can also check us out on the Anchor app. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.